I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback, the only podcast featuring NPR stories from exactly 25 years ago. And this month, we've got some fun stories. A couple serious ones, remember Walter Mondale? And one in particular that'll make you wish you had platform shoes and a boombox.
Chino Davila fits a typical profile of a successful breakdancer. He specializes in spinning on his head.
Spinning on your head may have been a good way to take in the world in September 83, though you wouldn't want to be too far from the nearest bottle of Motrin. But what about fun that's a little less labor-intensive? In this episode of Playback, we'll visit with Bob and Doug McKenzie, also known as Rick Moranis and Dave Thomas, the brothers from the Great White North.
It's beauty being on a satellite. I think it's my first time, eh?
Listen, we're not on the satellite, if you guys were concerned. We're not on a ball spinning above the Earth. This is just it's the satellite that takes the voices and brings them together, okay?
Oh, I thought you guys was up there.
Yeah, so stay tuned, because if you don't, you're a total hoser. We'll also hear from playwright David Mamet, who argues why he shouldn't be taken seriously.
So if I really thought of myself as a writer, I have to smoke a pipe. And I like tobacco, but the terrible thing about smoking a pipe is you got to carry a pouch, and you got to carry a cleaner, you got to carry a pipe, and it ruins the drape of your jacket.
We'll hear more about fashion and language from American playwright David Mamet, and music from the Talking Heads.
They seemed to be claiming, as they stood up there in their button-down shirts, that rock and roll was also the province of the wimps, of the good guys, of the straight people.
Good guys, wimps, straight people, whatever. We cover all the bases on this episode of Playback. Just as September 1983 was getting underway, tragedy struck Korean Airlines Flight 007. It was a civilian plane, a 747, with 269 passengers aboard. After straying into Soviet airspace, it was shot down by a Soviet fighter jet. There were no survivors. President Reagan called it the Korean Airlines massacre. Here's a report from NPR's Tom Jelton.
In his speech, President Reagan denounced the Soviet Union in some of the strongest language he has ever used. He said the attack on the Korean airliner was a crime against humanity that should never be forgotten. The president reported in considerable detail the U.S. version of events leading to the downing of the Korean jetliner. He said the Korean plane veered off course and into Soviet airspace for reasons that no one will ever know, and that Soviet fighter pilots were then ordered into the sky to follow it. To underscore his point that the pilots fully intended to destroy the aircraft, he even played part of a tape of the Soviet fighter pilots talking to their ground controllers.
Those were the voices of the Soviet pilots. In this tape, the pilot who fired the missile describes his search for what he calls the target. He reports he has it in sight. Indeed, he pulls up to within about a mile of the Korean plane, mentions its flashing strobe light and that its navigation lights are on. He then reports he's reducing speed to get behind the airliner, gives his distance from the plane at various points in this maneuver, and finally announces what can only be called the Korean airline massacre.
In a statement to the Soviet media released yesterday, the chief of the Soviet Air Defense Command said that the pilot might have mistaken the Korean airliner for a U.S. spy plane. That possibility was given new credence when White House officials admitted that a U.S. reconnaissance aircraft had been in the vicinity of the Korean plane before the shootdown. But the president said that because a 747 airliner has a distinctive shape, and because there was plenty of moonlight, there was no way the Soviet pilot could have been mistaken. The president said the world should not be surprised by the Soviet attack because it was consistent with a history of brutality, and he called on other countries to join the United States in condemning the Soviet Union.
From every corner of the globe, the word is defiance in the face of this unspeakable act, and defiance of the system which excuses it and tries to cover it up. With our horror and our sorrow, there is a righteous and terrible anger. It would be easy to think in terms of vengeance, but that is not a proper answer. We want justice and action to see that this never happens again.
Most of the president's speech was harsh words, however. He emphasized that effective retaliatory action had to be carried out in cooperation with other countries, and he did not go into detail about what should be done. He did say the Soviet Union should apologize to the rest of the world and clear all their facts about the shootdown. and he said they should pay compensation to the families of passengers killed in the shootdown. The president said that other countries should follow the example of Canada, who today suspended landing and refueling privileges for Aeroflot, the Soviet airline. The president had a special message for U.S. congressmen who will soon return from their recess to consider the defense budget.
I urge the members of that distinguished body to ponder long and hard the Soviets' aggression as they consider the security and safety of our people, indeed all people who believe in freedom.
Reagan's message to Congress was effective. After the Korean Airline incident, he was able to go forward with his plan to deploy Pershing II cruise missiles in West Germany, aimed within a 6 to 10 minute striking distance of Moscow. The Korean Airline shooting set off a tide of anti-Soviet sentiment in the U.S. Here's pollster Lou Harris.
Hostility in the United States toward the Soviet Union has now reached record proportions. It's gone from 88% to 7% before the shootdown to 93% to 5%. Not only that, but the number who think that the United States will be attacked by some major power like the Russians in the next 20 years has gone up 12 points from 45% to 57%. And indeed, by 65% to 34%, they think that this would include the use of nuclear weapons. That certainly is a sharp reaction that people have had.
The anti-Soviet feeling seemed to conflict with the strong anti-nuclear sentiment in the country, but Harris says that's not so.
Well, a question that's been assumed, I think, by large numbers in the Congress and by the media has been that, therefore, what people want is a response of more rapid arms buildup. It's been said by the press establishment that this is the end of the nuclear freeze movement. We don't find that is the case. The number of people, for example, in this country who favor a nuclear freeze, that has gone up from 64% to 28% who favored it back in April to a current 68% to 27% following the shootdown of the Korean plane.
That's Lou Harris with the results of a poll taken on September 14, 1983, 2 weeks after the Korean plane was shot down. Even a year out, the 84 presidential campaign was already beginning to generate some tasty sound bites. Here are a few from Democratic candidate Walter Mondale. His complaints about Ronald Reagan might sound familiar.
I think there's a feeling that he does not understand the complexities of the world, that he is not in charge of these matters the way he should be, but that there is concern and anxiety about his management of foreign policy, defense, security, and arms control matters is undoubtedly the case.
The concerns voters feel, and Mondale is talking to committed Democrats at this stage of the campaign, are most clearly expressed on current foreign policy issues. This was a speech delivered on Eileen Foley's back porch in Portsmouth, New Hampshire.
We're reminded again that this world is very complex and very, very dangerous. We see it in Central America, we see it in the Middle East, we saw this tragedy when the Soviets brutally shot down a civilian airplane. We better have a president who knows what he's doing.
That's right, a president who knows what he's doing. And here's Walter Mondale with this parting thought.
The final thing is we need a candidate who can win. This is one we do not dare lose. And with all humility, I'm the one that can defeat Mr. Reagan.
As it turns out, Walter Mondale lost to Reagan in one of the biggest landslides in electoral history. The only state he won was his home state, Minnesota. And if you're wondering about where things stand in this year's presidential election, go to npr.org/politics. There's also a new podcast you can download. It's called Political Rewind. Okay, time for a day brightener.
For many New York teenagers, breakdancing has replaced street gangs and basketball as a major competitive activity. Chino Davila fits a typical profile of a successful breakdancer. He's 15 years old, 5'3", 110 pounds, and he specializes in spinning on his head. Chino lives in one of the city's toughest neighborhoods, the South Bronx, and he channels every ounce of his energy into his art.
I practice every day on my breaking. I practice for at least I practice for around 12 hours. I practice from around 2 o'clock in the afternoon all the way down to 12, sometimes to 3 o'clock in the morning. Even if we go outside, some of our friends see us and they say, hey, Gino, you know, do something, let me see them, because they like the way we dance, they love it. So they say, could you do a little thing for me, you know, to show their girlfriend or, you know, just to make them happy.
There are two styles of breakdancing, a futuristic robot-like mime done standing up, and fast-paced acrobatic spins and windmills done on the floor. Teams of breakdancers alternate between the two styles with choreographed routines and solo moves timed to percussive music. Breaking began in the Bronx 6 years ago, along with a new way of playing records at clubs and parties. With two copies of the same record on separate turntables, neighborhood DJs experimented with indefinitely repeating the instrumental breaks on dance songs. Staff DJ Murray Elias at the new wave rock club The Ritz explains the effect of break mixing.
Disco records have these breaks that you could really go wild in dancing. And breaking came out of like taking the best parts of those records and just playing the drum breaks and like kind of doing this like chopped up style of dancing to the breaks in the records. People like to hear the lyrics and sing along, but when all of a sudden you get spacey drum echoes and like the bass and instruments reappearing and disappearing, it makes the record more exciting, and like that's what people really get off on in a part of a song as far as dancing.
One of the most popular moves in breakdancing is called the electric boogie, a mime routine simulating a robot as a wave of electricity passes from one isolated part of the body to the next. In the Rocker's Revenge crew, Chino Davila's acrobatics are offset by the work of a 17-year-old Harlem mime who calls himself Rage. Rage specializes in the shake, a high-speed trembling that looks like a mechanical man gone berserk. Last week, Rocker's Revenge was selected as one of the two finalists from Manhattan in a citywide competition judged by record company executives and guest panelist Moon Zappa. Rage says to him, the finals tonight mean a lot more than the $1,000 grand prize.
And you know, if you win, it's like you beat the city, because it's all like five boroughs going against each other, you know? That's the reason I want to win, because I want to feel proud, you know, at least, you know, if I, you know, I quit. You know, at least when I grow up, I feel good, you know, that I was a good dancer.
Will the Rocker's Revenge come out here, please?
In New York, I'm Tom Vitale for National Public Radio.
I'm Kerry Thompson, and you're listening to Playback. And now for a demographic that requires lots of hats, sunscreen, and positive reinforcement. Here's Linda Wertheimer.
Bald-headed men of America, may we help you?
May I speak to Mr. Capp, please?
Just a moment, please.
John Capps.
Mr. Capps?
Yes, ma'am.
You are the head of Bald-Headed Men of America?
That's right.
Now, I understand that you're having a convention.
We've got our 10th annual convention coming up. September the 10th, to honor those folks that have more head and less hair.
Where are you going to meet?
We're going to meet in the Bald Room at Ms. Willis's restaurant in downtown Morehead City, where our bald-headed mayor will extend everyone present a most cordial invitation.
What are you going to do at this meeting? I mean, what's on the agenda at a convention of bald-headed men?
Well, it's free and open to the public. And many of them, we let them get in twice free if they bring a bald-headed person. And during that period of time, we will have many of the bald-headed men there will share with us some of their personal experiences on their situation with baldness or what they have experienced. We'll also have an exchange of bald-headed jokes and stories, which is usually fun and laughter for a lot of folks. And then we'll get down and have contests for the best all-round bald head, prettiest bald head, sexiest bald head, smoothest bald head, and the most kissable bald head.
What do you hope to accomplish by getting all these folks together?
Nothing. Absolutely nothing.
Some refreshing honesty from John Capps, president of the Bald-Headed Men of America. And from bald heads to talking heads, here's rock critic Ariel Swartley.
One of the innovative things about the image that the talking heads presented was that they seemed to be claiming, as they stood up there in their button-down shirts, very stiffly, and they didn't dance, they didn't wear costumes, they had short, neatly combed hair, seemed to be arguing that rock and roll was also the province of the wimps, of the good guys, of the straight people. That even though you might not drive fast cars and be a hoodlum and wear a leather jacket, that you too might have burning passions that could only be expressed by loud, raucous dance music. Psycho killer.
The original members of Talking Heads came out of the Rhode Island School of Design around 1974. Singer-lyricist David Byrne, bass player Tina Weymouth, and drummer Chris France, later pianist Jerry Harrison, joined the group. Talking Heads brought the artistic concept of minimalism to the developing new wave music scene. The result, says Ariel Swartley, a cleaner, stripped-down-to-basics brand of rock music, with the anxious edge of David Byrne's vocal style.
Would it be fair to say that their sound is more mechanical than melodic?
I think certainly so at the beginning. This was a time, too, that people were experimenting in rock and roll as well as in some more avant-garde kinds of music with the sounds of machinery, with very mechanical rhythms. The Talking Heads did this particularly, you can hear it in Take Me to the River. This is a song that was their only top 40 hit that had been originally done by Memphis soul singer Al Green. It's practically a gospel song. It's one of those great secular gospel songs that the Talking Heads did in a much eerier, more mechanical fashion. All of the syncopations in Green's soul version were evened out. The beat is just like a spade hitting the edge of the table, very metallic and very regular. I like Burning Down the House because it has everything in it. It has their obsession with fire, with houses. I mean, these people have probably written more songs about buildings than any other band. There's something very tidy about the way the layers of rhythm are arranged, and there's also something very warm and absolutely captivating about the dance beat. All of the dance music that's coming out of synthesizer technology sounds like a pale version of the Talking Heads to me. They have found ways to make a mechanical rhythm be more compelling than a machine.
Lots more stories on David Byrne and the Talking Heads. Find them at npr.org/music. So you got your wimps, your nerds, your geeks. And what about American playwright David Mamet? He probably would opt out of those particular categories. He talked to NPR's Jay Kernis about his uncanny ability to write realistic-sounding dialogue.
I listen to everybody. Sure.
And you take notes?
Nah, very seldom. I very seldom take notes. I read something interesting a couple months ago. Freud was writing about the psychiatric interview. And he said, don't take notes. He said, you have to become part of what you're listening to. Freud said the only way he was able to keep the 6 to 7 patients a day straight over the period of months and years was not to take notes, was to listen to it with a certain kind of uncritical attention. And thereby he found that he put himself most in sync with the subconscious of the person speaking because he was listening with his own subconscious. And that struck me because I kind of think that's how I listen. Action is, in a play, is finally rhythm. When you watch somebody across a crowded railroad station, somebody arguing with his girlfriend or somebody arguing with her husband, or you know what they're doing, although you can't hear them. How you know what they're doing and more or less the subject of their conversation and what they want from each other is through the rhythm of their actions, through the rhythm of their gestures, through the rhythm of their speech. And it's just the same in a play.
Hello? It works. Rita, the machine works.
When I write a play, what I try to do is to make the rhythm of the speech act absolutely correct to what the people want.
From American Buffalo. What is it?
I saw him.
Who?
The guy.
You saw the guy?
Yes.
That I'm talking about?
Yes.
Just now?
He's going somewhere.
He is?
Yeah, he's putting a suitcase in the car.
Good dialogue has to be written quickly. You can't labor over good dialogue, or else it will be labored. On the other hand, a play has to be carefully structured, so the difficulty is the dialogue has to be written quickly, but the play itself has to be structured, for many of them, over a long, long, long period of time. So the problem of technique comes in meshing those two. I guess it still is difficult for me to characterize myself as a writer. You know, Tennessee Williams, rest in peace, he was a writer, or Willa Cather, or Sherwood Anderson, or Jack London or Somerset Maugham, those people were writers. You know, I suppose I am too, but I mean, I've written stuff that's as good as the stuff that they've written. But over the course of time, the work that they did and the amount of work that they did and the brilliance of the work that they did consistently, I mean, they're great idols of mine. And I think of them as, I think of them as writers. I mean, also, if I really thought of myself as a writer, I'd have to smoke a pipe. And the I like tobacco, but the terrible thing about smoking a pipe is you got to carry a pouch and you got to carry a cleaner, you got to carry a pipe, and it ruins the drape of your jacket.
And who wants to hang around a lumpy pocketed playwright, even if he is David Mamet? 6 months after he did this interview, Mamet won the Pulitzer Prize for Drama for his play, Glengarry Glen Ross. And, as it turns out, if you put on a flannel shirt and sit around drinking beer and talk with an accent, you too can become a megastar. The Canadian brothers, Bob and Doug McKenzie, otherwise known as Rick Moranis and Dave Thomas, joined NPR's Scott Simon for a chat.
How's it going?
Fine.
You're in Washington, D.C., eh?
Washington, D.C., indeed.
It's beauty being on a satellite. I think it's my first time, eh?
Well, listen, we're not on the satellite, if you guys were concerned. We're not on a ball spinning above the Earth. This is just, it's the satellite that takes the voices and brings them together, okay?
Oh, I thought you guys was up there.
There's a minute, eh? Like, our voices are up there for just a minute, eh? So, like, now you and Yuri Gagarin are the first voice in space, eh?
Go on.
How's it going in D.C., eh? Do you ever meet Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. down there or anybody else from the FBI?
Yeah, does everybody really drive Fords?
Unmarked, yeah. Plain black unmarked Fords and license plates with just 3 or 4 numbers. I want to take advantage of your expert opinion to ask you about American beer.
Okay.
Oh, beauty.
Go ahead.
Okay, what about American beer?
Well, it's only like half alcohol by volume, eh? So immediately half your fun is gone.
Yeah, Canadian beer's a little stronger, eh?
Okay.
Other than that, we got no beefs with it. We just got to drink twice as much when we're here, eh?
Especially since now a lot of people are saying, hey, Hosers are here, have a beer on me. So we're drinking free beer. So when people's buying us beer, we don't care what brand it is, eh?
That's his favorite brand, OPs, other people, eh?
Good day, welcome to school. I'm Principal Bob McKenzie. This is my Vice Principal Doug.
How's it going, eh?
Okay, so good day, welcome to school. And today we're not going to have the National Anthem or the Lord's Prayer. Instead, we're going to have our theme.
Okay, everyone ready? Will you sing
stand. With me, standing in unison. Okay, be seated.
What's it like for two, Northern Ontario boys like you from up near Timmins or something, to come down to the United States and go on a movie tour?
Like, yeah. See, it's not so, you're talking like we're not from Spain or nothing, eh? Like, you know, we got McDonald's and Coca-Cola and stuff like that all up in Canada. So, like, it's not as though we don't even know what it's like here, eh? Like, we get all the same movies, all the same TV, everything.
I like your money, eh? Because it's like, if they give us, you know what per diems are?
Sure, sure. Yeah.
It's like money. Some lady comes up to you with a brown envelope and hands you wads of cash and says, okay, this is for your tour. And then they pay for everything on your tour, so you get to pocket the cash, eh? And then you take that home.
And it's worth 20% more.
Like, you, for every dollar American, you can go up to Canada, you get a dollar and a quarter back, eh? Yeah. And the money in Canada is colored. So you don't, like, if you get, like, a wad of 10s and 20s and stuff like that, and 1s and 5s American, you don't know what's what because it's all the same color. But up there, like, they got different prime ministers on them, different scenes on the back, different colors. It's beauty money, like Monopoly, eh?
I'm Bob McKenzie. It's my brother Doug. So good day.
This is where the DJ talks. Don't say anything.
Okay.
So that's about it for our show today. Support for this episode of Playback was provided by those guys from the Great Fifth Floor, Robert Speer and Mikey Katziff.
Okay. Good day. Welcome to our single. I'm Bob McKenzie, and this is my brother Doug. How's it going, eh?
Beauty, eh?
Yeah, I like that.
And okay. We happen to have Michael Katziff with us here. Mikey, what's happening with our show for next month?
I don't know.
You don't know?
No.
And you have no simple idea?
No. Probably something about Halloween.
Halloween? Oh, yeah, it's October.
And my birthday.
Okay, so it's going to be good, though, and thanks for listening. I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback from NPR.
Decent singing, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's good.
Okay, so good day. Our topic today is music.
That's right, like, because my brother and I are now experts in the field,
yeah,
eh?
Yeah, right, because we're a band now. And,
well, except for him. I'm a band.
Oh, how can you do that? You're making me look bad. You're such a hose hand.
Yeah, well, take off.
Take off to the great white north. Take off. It's a beauty.
Listen to this, it's coming. You know what it is?
What?
It's a drum solo.
Okay, everyone, like, this is me on the drums,
oh,
eh?
Get out. It is not.
It is so.
Stop
I
lying,
learned.
Will you?
Take off, eh?
Oh,
take off to the great white north. Take off. It's a beauty way to go. Take off to the great white north. Take off. It's a beauty way to go. Take off.
Beauty, eh? Like magic, eh? It's coming in.
Well, that's like...
like it was sung by angels.
Hey, Hosehead.
Yeah, what?
Guess what?
What?
It's over.
Take off. That can't be.
It is, yeah. It is.
Because
hit records are short.
Like, no way.
Yeah, they're not that long. Okay, so that's our topic for today. So good day.
Good day.
Hey, you guys.
What?
Take off.
Hey, no. Hey, don't go.
No, come back, eh? Oh,
look what you did. Everybody's gone.
You see you.
Come back. I won't let him do it again.
Yeah.
My fault was, yeah, your fault.
Such a hoser.
There's no way I'll ever do another record with you, hoser. Yeah.
Okay, that's fine. I'll do a solo album.
Fine, and you'll be looking for me,
yeah,
like,
I will
on
not.
Another label.
Oh, now everybody's gone. Good day.
Good day.